If it please the court, Josh Maximon, attorney registration number 33870 for the appellant, Jared Pinnell. So appreciate your initial comments regarding mootness. I figured that was going to be the first thing the court wanted to hear, and I understand the order saying that the case is moot. The order didn't talk about the acceptance, and I think all of the litigants here agree that the case is moot. What we disagree.
Well, if there's an exception to the mootness doctrine, it's not moot.
Okay.
I mean, that's the approach taken, so.
Okay. Well, so, I mean, I guess to state our position clearly, we agree that it's moot, but we think that it falls within the exception to the mootness doctrine, which I understand what you're saying is means that it's not moot, that it's capable of repetition, yet evades review. I think that this is a paradigmatic type of case of capable of repetition, yet evading review. We have both sides of the bar who are in the trenches every day dealing with defense or with criminal cases, and there are issues in each of these preliminary hearings about whether we serve a subpoena on an eyewitness or direct viewer of the criminal episode. And if that subpoena is quashed, as it sometimes is, sometimes ex parte, what's the appropriate forum in which to challenge that procedural ruling? The fact that both sides are here in agreement that's something that comes up in each of these criminal cases with respect to preliminary hearings, I think that really goes to the capable of repetition. This is something that every time I have a case going to preliminary hearing, it's something that I consider about serving a subpoena on the eyewitness, and if it's quashed, what the appropriate place is to challenge that. So,
why is not Rule 21 available?
Well, I think that's kind of getting to the merits. But so why isn't Rule 21 is not available? Because Rule 21 says that there can't be another forum. And so it means.
But it's Rule 106. Rule 106 is only available if.
Right, and it's our position, based on reading Zaharia and Abbott, that 106 is an available forum. So
I'm missing what you're saying. Is an available forum? Is that what you said?
Right, based on Zaharia and Abbott, 106 is an available forum. So Rule 21 wouldn't be applicable.
So he pled guilty ultimately.
He did plead guilty ultimately, but so I think that goes to the capable of repetition. The evading review has two components typically, two characteristics. One being the period of time. So these cases come up in terms of school cases, fifth-year seniors who are trying to play sports, trying to go in the marching band. There's a water law decision about a policy that exists for 1 year. A legislative session that's 120 days. That's similar to a criminal case where the speedy trial statute has a six-month time period. And so that's one characteristic of it, the time period being shorter than could be satisfied in an appeal. The second characteristic of it is that the right is eventually extinguished. And that applies in this situation as well, because once it goes to trial, the preliminary hearing issue disappears either way. If it's not guilty, the defendant obviously isn't going to be pursuing it. If it is guilty, then the issue disappears in the Alexander case and in the Kuipers case, both cited in the briefing that we provided. It says that there's no way you're going to get to a preliminary hearing issue about probable cause when there's already been a finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So we think that it has both of those characteristics.
Well, Mr. Maximon, here's my question. In this case, there is the availability of having a stay of criminal proceedings. So how does that impact your analysis that in all cases it would be capable of repetition yet evading review?
And I think that's a good question. And so that's what we did. We filed a motion. As soon as we filed our Rule 106A4 complaint, we also filed a motion to stay the case, and that was denied. And also we filed a Rule 21 appeal of that decision denying our attempt to stay the case. And so as soon as that decision regarding the motion to stay is denied, there's going to be no way to have this issue ever heard by a court, because the criminal case is going to be over. And I hope I've answered your question. I know that Judge Roy asked me another question about whether ultimately we ended up pleading, entering into some kind of a plea agreement. And what I would say to the court about that is, it's actually not the moment that this case became moot. The moment became moot earlier when we showed up for trial on April the 14th, and the DA dismissed the burglary charge, the second degree burglary charge, which was the only reason we had a preliminary hearing in the first place, and the only reason that the case was bound over. So it wasn't based on an agreement between the parties. It was based on the dismissal of the burglary charge at the time that we showed up for trial, and then the case got continued and ultimately ended up having a disposition. But it's our position that that doesn't matter. It wouldn't matter if we had entered into an agreement, or if the case got dismissed by the prosecutor. What's significant is that there is no case law to say that somehow a plea agreement abrogates this evading review analysis. And none of the cases cited stands for that a plea agreement impacts whether or not a situation evades review, because clearly this one does. Oh, I apologize.
That's fine. Okay. I would have stopped you if I was upset.
I believe you.
We'll just use 4 minutes as a guide.
The court's pleasure, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Chris Zenisek, registration number 34093. And I'm the Assistant District Attorney for the 20th Judicial District in Boulder County, Colorado. Your Honor, just jumping right into the mootness issue. Again, it is our position that, especially as to the issue on cross appeal regarding jurisdiction, that this is an issue that's capable of repetition, yet evading review. And the reason is this. Coming out of a preliminary hearing, what you have, of course, is if a defendant so chooses to challenge under Rule 106, they file a civil case. So we have a civil case on one hand, we have a criminal case proceeding to arraignment on the other hand, and I think in the vast majority of circumstances, 9 out of every 10, that's not a scientific number, but the criminal case will proceed more quickly than the civil case. And moreover, for the civil case to reach all the way to your desk is going to be, I think, an extremely rare set of circumstances for this civil case to be reviewed by the district court and then brought to you and reviewed by you and have sufficient time for you to issue an opinion, all before this district court case, criminal case, gets resolved over here. Now, the bench had, I think very appropriately so, asked questions about what about the plea agreement. And that's certainly the case that under most circumstances, a plea agreement would make an issue moot. But the cases we're discussing there are, first of all, a more direct circumstance. So, for instance, a Fourth Amendment search and seizure issue where a defendant goes back and tries to reopen a plea and say, you know, I want to revoke that plea. Well, that issue is moot because they've entered a plea as to that direct set of circumstances. This case, there is no resolution with the exception of the district court's orders on the motion to dismiss and on the merits of the Rule 106 petition. There is no resolution of the underlying case, the civil case, before you hear today. Now, clearly, it's related to the criminal case because it impacts Mr. Pinnell's preliminary hearing in his criminal case. But it's a little bit of a different posture than all the cases that would be brought before you regarding mootness and plea agreements. And so, with that in mind, I guess I just mentioned that, for instance, the Abbott versus County Court case, which is where we really see this line of authority begin regarding procedural is okay for Rule 106, substantive is not okay. And I've researched this, and I've not been able to find a case since then discussing what is procedural, What is substantive? What does that really mean? And there's a kind of a can of worms within there. Judge Lichtenstein had a very important question about stays. And the answer in part there is, what happens if a stay were to issue? And my recollection is a little different on this. In fact, I think the district court did issue a stay on this matter initially. And then on our motion, we considered that order and lifted the stay after we were brought into the case. But how can it be, for instance, that a district court, civil division, can stay a proceeding that's been bound over and is currently proceeding in the district court?
The stay was in the civil action, not in the criminal action? I thought the stay was in the criminal action.
The stay was entered by the civil court,
judge.
By a civil judge. And it is a little bit juxtaposed, because actually it may have been the same judge. Judge Whalen Barreau was actually the judge who had the civil case initially. There was a rotation, and eventually she picked up the criminal case.
I thought it was Judge Montgomery.
Judge Montgomery picked up the civil case when Judge Whalen rotated from civil to criminal.
Right, so the judge issuing the stay issued a stay in the criminal, stay of criminal proceedings.
Correct. The stay filed by Mr. Pinnell in the civil proceeding was a request to stay criminal proceedings. That stay was initially granted. We moved for reconsideration in part based on how can one district court effectively enjoin a judge across the hall in the same district court. Judge Whalen then reconsidered that motion and lifted the stay. I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Maurice Kneiser. I'm with the Attorney General's office here on behalf of Judge Stavely. My registration number is 5264. I'll try not to take my full 4 minutes. I'd just like to emphasize a couple of points. Both of the other counsel in this case raised two issues. Number one, whether or not this matter is capable of repetition yet evading review. And the other issue that they raised in their briefs was whether or not this is an issue of public importance. With regard to the question of whether or not it's capable of repetition yet evading review, in almost all of the cases that I'm aware of, that issue, the courts have considered that as an exception to the mootness doctrine when there are issues beyond the control of the parties. And in this particular case, that is not the situation. The circumstance here is that both parties agreed to a resolution of the underlying matter. So the fact of the matter is that in most circumstances where you see capable of repetition yet evading review is when there are circumstances beyond the control of the party. That is not the case here. Probably the most famous case was the case out of the U.S. Supreme Court dealing with abortion rights back in the 70s, and the case out of Iowa. This case is probably most similar to the case that we cited in our brief concerning whether or not a party could raise the issue of search and seizure in a criminal case. And the court found that because the party had pled out and waived the right to a trial, they really couldn't raise the issue of search and seizure on appeal.
Mr. Kneiser, I have two questions. The first question is this an observation that cases that employ the capable of repetition yet evading review are where it's out of control, or is there of the parties, or is there a case that states that?
I am not aware of a case that states that. There may be. I did not cite it in my brief. I am not aware of one. But otherwise, really, I would argue that it doesn't fit the definition of capable of repetition yet evading review, because the whole idea is that it evades review because there are things beyond the control of the party. Otherwise, you would run into a situation where the parties could stipulate to a matter and then appeal it to the court. So in essence, what they would be doing is asking for an advisory opinion. And so that's really sort of the source of my thinking on that. But I am not aware of a particular case.
All right. My next question is, I just heard that it was the dismissal of the burglary charge that was a basis for an argument of this being mooted out. And how would that be in the control of the defendant if he were challenging this?
Well, it's my understanding that the dismissal of the charge was based upon an agreement of the parties. It wasn't anything that it was beyond the control of either one of the parties. As far as I know, and I am not privy to the record on this since Judge Stavely was not a party to the district court proceeding, but it's my understanding that this really had to do with an agreement among the parties.
So it was a part of the plea agreement?
It was a part of the plea agreement. It's my understanding, and I wasn't a part of that. I think the other party, the other attorneys here would have to confirm that.
My understanding, that's not part of our record. However, there is a stipulation that there was a plea agreement.
There was a stipulation that there was a plea agreement. That was part of the registry of actions in the lower court. The other issue that was brought up in the briefs, although not here in argument, was the fact that this is a matter of public importance. And I would argue, and I think you'll see this during the course of the argument on the substance, is that this is really not a matter of public importance because it has been decided in the past. The real issue here is the application of the law to a particular set of facts. That historically has not been the grounds for the court finding that a matter is a matter of public importance. Generally, the Supreme Court has held that it's a matter of public importance when it's an undecided issue, as opposed to an application to a particular set of facts.
What about the motion to stay being granted or denied? There's no ability to stay the criminal case pending the resolution of the 106?
Well, the fact of the matter is that it is true that the motion to stay was lifted, but I'm not sure that really relates to the issue of public importance. That probably goes to the issue of whether or not it's capable of repetition yet evading review. I think the particular response there is that there was review. There was review by the district court. Really what the plaintiffs are arguing, or what the parties are arguing, is they have the right to appeal to the Court of Appeals. They actually had review of this by a court exercising appellate jurisdiction. The question then becomes whether or not they have the right to take it up, whether or not it's a constitutional right to take it up beyond that point. So I think it was reviewed. It was reviewed by the district court. That's the whole purpose of Rule 106, it seems to me. Thank you.
And that terminates the arguments on mootness. Now I have to address the merits. And my understanding is that I'm not quite sure where the merits go. That's one of the problems I have. Is it seems to me the merits is whether you have a right to call a witness and subpoena the witness, and that's well established. You have the right to do that, and whether or not you have a right to bring a 106 proceeding, and that's reasonably well established. So is there any dispute about either of those two issues?
As it applies to this case, I would dispute the second one.
Okay. What's your pleasure on time? You want about 7 minutes apiece? 5 minutes apiece?
I think I could do it in 5 minutes.
Well, you thought you could do it in 4 minutes.
I'm trying to take 30 seconds to add it to my up-to-date.
There's only two sides to this argument, right? Or are there three sides to this argument?
Two sides to two different arguments.
That's you and the defense attorney, Mr. Pinnell, and the district attorney's office.
That's correct.
You have no real interest.
Your Honor, that's correct. I mean, we sided with, you know, we defended the position with regard to the maximum argument, the position with regard to the district attorney's cross appeal. And frankly, I was not planning to take a lot of time before.
You want to be heard on this issue?
I don't think I need to be heard. I can allow the district attorney to take my time.
5 minutes aside.
Thank you. As I indicated, I would like to respond to Judge Lichtenstein's question about the dismissal of the regarding mootness and the dismissal of the burglary charge.
Take him off the clock.
Okay, I apologize.
I'm sorry. Give him 5 minutes. The question is, I think the question is, was the case dismissed, was the burglary dismissed as a part of a plea bargain?
And it was not. And so in April 14th, when we showed up for trial, on a a motion by the district attorney in the interest of justice, because they couldn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, they dismissed the burglary charge, which was the only reason we were having the preliminary hearing in the first place. There was no plea agreement, no agreement to anything. And that is in my brief in terms of setting out the procedural history. I know there was a stipulation also to supplement the record, if that's what the court wanted, to have information about how what happened in the plea agreement. But essentially what happened is, on April 14th, the burglary charge was dismissed. Then the district attorney moved to amend their complaint to do a trespass charge rather than a burglary charge. And the court granted that motion to have a trespass charge and dismissed the burglary charge. And then 2 months later, as we were a week away from trial on the second time, the parties entered into a plea agreement.
Either the trespass?
To a deferred sentence regarding the trespass, correct.
And okay. I take it you wanted to call the victim because she would have said he had consent to be in the house?
Yes, the victim was going to say that he had consent to be in the house. The victim was also going to say that, give her impressions regarding his mental state. Burglary is a specific intent crime, so voluntary intoxication is a defense there. She was going to give all sorts of impressions about the way he was in the bed that we think would have shown that that there wasn't probable cause to go forward regarding burglary. And the ironic thing about the case is that ultimately the district attorney moved on its own to dismiss the burglary, because as they got to trial, they realized that the permission to be in the home part, which was the exact question I was going to ask, was a problem for them. And they also realized that the specific intent issue about the impressions of him in the bed, again, exactly the questions that I was going to ask in the preliminary hearing, were problems for them. And that's why they said that they couldn't prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Hey, so, you're starting on your time.
Okay. I appreciate it. So let me address the merits of the claim that we have, which is that you have a procedural right based in Rule 5 and Rule 7 of the Colorado Rules of Criminal Procedure to cross-examine witnesses and to introduce evidence. And that includes being able to subpoena a witness, an eyewitness, a direct, someone with direct perception of the criminal episode. When we look at these cases, there are two lines of cases having to do with preliminary hearings. One is the sufficiency of the evidence regarding non-hearsay testimony. And those cases are things like Maestas, Van Mervin, and recently the Court of Appeals issued a case called Huggins. And that talks about whether there is sufficient non-hearsay evidence to go forward. And it just has to be a smidge, really, of non-hearsay evidence to go forward. That's not our case. We're not talking about whether there was sufficient evidence. What we're talking about is a separate line of cases. And those are cases, and I take them in order, like McDonald, which we think is the most significant. Let me start in order of when they were issued by the Colorado Supreme Court. Kuipers, Rex, McDonald, and Blevins. Those are the cases that talk about the right of the defendant to introduce evidence at their preliminary hearing or to cross-examine. The Kuipers case was one where the Supreme Court held that as long as it's cross-examination regarding an issue of probable cause, defense gets to ask the question. The Rex case was, there was a 7-year-old girl who had, quote, weak or non-existent testimony. Essentially, she didn't have direct perception of the criminal episode. And the court said that she couldn't testify because she was 7 years old, had weak or non-existent testimony, and also they were going to allow two other witnesses who did have direct perception. There was a doctor who testified in that case, as well as a forensic specialist. So they didn't allow the 7-year-old to testify, but they allowed, because she didn't have direct perception, but they allowed two other witnesses with direct perception to testify. 35 days after Rex, McDonald comes out, and it says, when you put on two police officers who the bulk of their testimony is hearsay, you're allowed to call an eyewitness. Then the next case that comes along is Blevins, and Blevins says, as long, and it was two people in the same car, and Blevins says, as long as you have one witness who's an eyewitness or a direct, has direct perception of the criminal episode, that's enough. So we think all of those cases actually support the position that Ms. Quinn, in this case, should have been allowed to testify at the preliminary hearing. McDonald, in our opinion, is on all fours with this case. There were two officers that testified. The first one, who had interviewed the victim and related stories about what the victim said and could give her demeanor, and that was similar to Officer Logue in our case. And the second officer came in and talked about identification, which is the same thing as Officer Jersinia in this case.
Mr. Maximin, let me ask you, in the facts of this case, we have officers who observed the accused in the bed. And so are those how are those facts not distinguishable from McDonald then?
Well, I think that's right. I think that's right at the heart of this. And so Officer Jersinia did have some non-hearsay observations of him in bed. There's no question about that. But that is a far cry from what an eyewitness. This is during her investigation, hours after the criminal episode, she had some observations which were not hearsay. But that is very different from McDonald, the person who was an eyewitness of the criminal episode. Maestas talks about direct perception of the criminal episode. Blevins, there was the driver in the car, had the gun pointed at them right as they hit the brakes when the gun went off. That was an eyewitness during the course of the criminal episode. And so we would argue that although she does have some observations that are non-hearsay regarding the bed, this is hours after after the criminal episode, while she's doing her investigation, and it's very different than someone who is an eyewitness in the course of the criminal episode, who's watching what's going on, and that critical time was when they were in the same room together, when Mr. Pinnell and Ms. Quinn were in the same room together.
But neither, arguably at least, neither the fact that he was in the bed, did not go to the burglary charge.
Well,
that he was in the house.
Well, if he was unlawfully in the dwelling of another for the purpose of committing a crime, so yep, correct. So
I mean,
in the bed.
I mean, yeah, just the fact that he's in the bed is not evidence that he got there by means of a burglary.
Correct.
And the mere fact that he's in the bed does not mean that he sexually assaulted the victim.
Correct.
Did you have an opportunity to make an offer of proof at the preliminary hearing as to what the witness would testify to?
Your Honor, we did. And we filed a motion, a response to the motion to quash, saying that it went to the issue of whether he was unlawfully in the dwelling of the other, preserved this issue perfectly, as well as talking about mental state, observations regarding mental state, because it's a specific intent crime, and also the factual issue regarding whether there was consent for the sexual assault. So,
I'm sorry to interrupt. You filed the motion to stay.
Correct.
And did you file that in the criminal district court?
The motion to stay was filed in the civil case.
Why not in the criminal case?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think that it was appropriate that, in terms of the 106, the power to stay the case would have been with the judge deciding the appeal of the 106 rather than the criminal judge itself. I should say this. We did ask for the judge in the criminal case because Judge Whalen ended up taking over this case. When she was reconsidering her motion, we also asked her to stay as she became the criminal judge. And she said, no, we need to go to immediate arraignment. So we exhausted every effort in the civil and the criminal to try to stop the case and even filed the Rule 21 petition after we lost the motion to stay. And the other thing is Mr. Zenisek's recollection regarding how it went with the stay originally granted and then reconsidered is accurate. Sorry, I did it again.
you just have a spellbinding way.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Your Honor, Mr. Maximon raises a lot of different issues and a lot of different cases, discusses a lot of different cases, but I would suggest that as to the direct appeal, it really comes down to two cases, if you accept jurisdiction over it, because it is a moot issue and it has been decided. But first is Harris. And again, just a reminder, Harris is a Colorado Supreme Court case that says directly that a defendant is not entitled to compel the victim of an alleged offense to testify at a preliminary hearing. That's 843 P. 2nd, 1316 from 1993. The second case is McDonald versus District Court, which is 576 P. 2nd, 169. And that's the case I think that Mr. Maximon is relying on quite heavily, and he says it's really similar to this. Well, as the court pointed out, it is different than this, because what McDonald said was, where testimony is reliant almost completely on hearsay testimony, and it uses those words, that raises a circumstance where a defendant can at least call, if somebody's available, can at least call that person to come up and testify regarding eyewitness testimony. And as the court mentioned, this is a case where there is at least some direct testimony. It wasn't during the episode of the crime itself, but this is identification of the individual based on a description and a location and where he is within the bed and when they discover him. And so I think it's pretty clear, based on those two cases alone, that this is not a McDonald case, this is a Harris case, and there is no right to compel the victim at this particular preliminary hearing. Now, you know, Mr. Maximon also discussed how what the substance of her testimony was expected to be with regard to permission and everything else. I haven't focused on those aspects because actually, I spoke with Mr. Maximon a little bit before today, and he actually raised this prospect to me. But what I can tell you is that the county court found each and every element to have been provided probable cause in support of. So had the victim shown up and testified in such a way, I would presume that in the record there is also evidence that he was not invited, that he was not welcome there, because without that evidence it would have never been bound over in the first place. And that gets me really to the second
point. Well, it seemed to me the only way that evidence could have come in, and I have not looked at it, is by hearsay, by the officer testifying as to what the victim said. Or to the officer.
Or Your Honor, testifying as to what one of the other individuals in the house said.
Well, it could be.
Which, my recollection is that may be the case. I would have to look at the record to know for sure. But there must have been some kind of evidence. And really, that's what this appeal is about. Because when this 106 is filed, Mr. Pinnell requests that a new preliminary hearing issue, and that it was a procedural right, but that it impacted substantive rights that he has. And if you look at this case, it's really just the other opposite side of the coin from Abbott. And Abbott, as we know, is the case that distinguishes procedural is okay, substantive is not okay. And what happened in Abbott was a preliminary hearing happened, a case bound over, based on there not being eyewitness testimony. The district court reviewed the substance of the preliminary hearing and reversed it. By the time that got to the Supreme Court, the petitioner, on behalf of Mr. Abbott, was arguing that this was actually a procedural ruling because it was reliant on there not being a perceiving witness, and therefore the district court's ruling was a procedural one, not a substantive one. What the Abbott court said about that was, we're not going to stretch the limits of what's procedural in order to allow substantive challenges to be basically shoehorned into a procedural bucket. So this is the same issue, really. It's a witness, and what could be more substantive than a witness testifying at a preliminary hearing? It's a witness coming to a preliminary hearing for testimony, and Mr. Maximon did a nice job of representing this individual and creating the appeal and couching it in very procedural terms, But make no mistake, what we're talking about is whether this witness comes to a preliminary hearing and testifies regarding the substance of probable cause.
Well, my question for you is, the issue here is whether the court was correct in quashing a subpoena.
That's one issue, Your Honor, and the issue on cross-appeal is whether the district court erred when it concluded that it had subject matter jurisdiction based on Abbott and calling this a procedural appeal rather than a substantive one.
And so just to clarify, this was not dealing with a finding of probable cause. It's dealing with whether or not a witness could testify at a preliminary hearing.
If I understand your question correctly, yes.
The basis for the 106. So the question is this substantive or is it procedural?
Correct.
Right. And so what I'm just trying to clarify is the ruling that was being challenged in the 106 had nothing to do with the court's ultimate finding of probable cause.
I would respectfully disagree with that conclusion because, first of all, he asked for another probable cause hearing. Second, the basis for that is the quashing of the subpoena to the victim. And third is what the victim's expected to testify and how that would impact the merits of probable cause. So while it is very much phrased as a procedural review, there's no question about it trying to reach a substantive impact of that review. And I believe that steps out of the bounds of Abbott. Thank you.
Here's that. For at least the first time since I've been on the court, that the clock is advisory only. But the case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.